My name is Chris Blizzard. I am also from Red Hat, like most of these folks. I'm here to talk about the Netscape, mostly the Netscape directory server project that we're going to be starting up at some point in the future, hopefully within the next few weeks, maybe a month or so. It's not going to be quite as sexy as what you just saw, right? I don't know how a lot of demos. I will demo at the end what some of the stuff we can do with some of this technology. And I'm hoping that we'll get into it. I'll go through this stuff pretty quick. It's probably pretty familiar to a lot of folks. A few months ago, you know, as it's probably pretty well known, Red Hat acquired what were formerly the Netscape servers. You know, they had a mail server, they had a calendar server, they had a directory server. They also had this pretty neat security system server. It's basically a CA in a box. Pretty customizable, nice software. We also got a large group of people to go along with it to support it. Those are customers, kind of nice. But sort of what we have to worry about then is what do we do? Because we're an open source company, what do we do about open sourcing? What's the process for that? How do we take, you know, this multi-million line piece of code and turn it into a project which people are going to hopefully get involved with and be able to participate in and feel like they have some ownership? So I was going to go through some of the issues that we went through and some of the answers to before we come up with. It's pretty simple stuff. From our view, within Red Hat, we had to worry sort of about how we worry about a product that Red Hat delivers versus a project which people participate in. Two very basic ideas, similar in scope, right? When you're dealing with product issues, when you know you want to feature your product, you have to figure out how to integrate this project, whether or not it goes upstream, whether or not you fork it. So we need to figure out what the product looks like first, and then we can figure out how we want to derive the project. We have to worry about due diligence. This is code that comes from the outside world. Netscape comes from a couple other companies too, right? If you look at the copyrights on the code, you got Netscape, you got Sun, you got AOL all over it. So we had to figure out where all these pieces of code come from. Some of that's done upstream, some of that's done by us too. We got backend code, we got servers, we got front-end code, we got administration tools. We have to worry about what to do about external dependencies. In this case, the code itself is actually built on top of a lot of sort of common functionality shared between the servers. It's easier to open source pieces of it than others. Some pieces of some of the servers are still dependent on proprietary software, so we have to figure out where to replace it, if there are alternatives. And we also have to worry about what platforms we want to support. In this case, Linux is probably our primary target. We also have to support HPUX. We have to support Windows for some client stuff, believe it or not, which is sort of a new foray for us. And Mac too on the client side for sure. But it's built on the same technology, almost the exact same technology as Mozilla is built on. And Mozilla is actually pretty portable source code. Most of it's handled by some of the core build libraries, so there isn't that much that needs to change. From a product standpoint, this is pretty simple. Key part of our open source architecture. We have an architecture, that's a long story in itself. Michael gets
well done.
The biggest reason that we purchased the software was really because we wanted a directory server, and we wanted to, so we have a lot of flack for it. But I'm going to say it again, OpenLDAP is out there. I suspect a lot of people in this room have had to deal with OpenLDAP in the past. It's nice software, it's been around for a long time, it's got a reasonably healthy project. But I wouldn't want to deploy it to millions of people for millions of people to use. You got to restart it all the time for various things. It's just not what we were looking for. And this opportunity came up, so we pursued it. But we need to find better integration with other parts of the operating system. That's what that means. We want to use it for authentication for everything. We want to be able to stuff all our settings in it. We want customers to be able to customize all the pieces that they want to be able to customize on the schema side. And maybe easy for them to do so and build a supportable product around it. They want to see how deep we can get this integrated into the operating system. It should be pretty exciting. From a client standpoint, it's actually kind of nice. there is a pretty standard C-based API for LDAP stuff. So, you know, portability isn't actually that huge a problem from the client side. You know, the holy grail is always single sign-on. Everybody wants to have a single point for authentication and authorization services for all their products, you know, all the stuff they use. We can get pretty close with this, especially with the security side of the equation. The LDAP server is the most important part of that, though. It's a place to store all that information, and it's really easy to get applications to use it. So, yeah, we want to attain feature parity and competition. You have Novell out there, you got Sun out there. Sun has the same product based on the same source code, it's exciting. And, you know, we've got Active Directory out there, too. So we're going to see how close we can get. I want to talk a little bit about the actual directory server itself, is what I'm going to focus on mostly. The Netscape directory server is pretty old, you know, it's been around for 9 years. It's based on the old,
did I spell that correctly?
Yeah, okay. It's based on the old source code from the University of Michigan way back when. You know, Netscape originally hired, you know, the luminaries of LDAP at those times, Mark and Gordon and a bunch of other people too. And this is based on the same source code that they were working on. The core code itself, just giving you an even scale, is about 1.8 million lines of code. And that's just the core of the LDAP server. That doesn't include much of many of the components that are, you know, that it uses. There are a lot of software libraries that it pulls in. There's a lot of, this doesn't include stuff like client-side administration. This is just the source code for the directory server. Doesn't actually scare that me that much. This work on Mozilla, which is about twice as big, so it's not too bad. It has been very well maintained, lovingly maintained, like I said. And it is in use in several companies and organizations that I won't mention by name, but we're talking about millions of users, we're talking about millions of accesses. It has scaled beautifully. And it is very performant and very reliable. Sort of enterprise class features, things like multi-master replication, which allow you to have multiple servers out there that can act as the master, you can update multiple servers, you know, it can be forwarding to other servers for certain types of queries. It's really set up to be able to scale well and be very reliable. Yeah, we really like it as well software. So we got a whole team along with the acquisition provided based out on you. So now we come back to the open source question. For Red Hat in particular, you know, open source is such an important part of our brand identity. It's something we have to do. I don't think we would be, we made an announcement about purchasing these assets. We wouldn't be good to our customers if we didn't take it into the open source world, for sure. We know how it benefits our customers, we know how it benefits our ability to do business. We have to do it. You know, it allows you to live beyond your means because you're working together, so against each other. You can learn marketplace ideas, better quality, patches. Everybody here knows how open source works, so I won't get into that too much. You know, you sit down and you got to write down goals, what you want a project to look like, what kind of things you want to foster. You know, it's really about people. It's not really about software. It's really about sort of projects and how you build it. It's about how you get people to participate. You know, how do you make them feel welcome? How do you make them feel like they're part of the process? How do you make sure that they're getting what they need while you are still getting what you need as well? And building such tracks, I think that's always the thing that sort of drives up. I remember who said that originally.
Yeah,
it's Scratch. That's what drives open source. I gotta fix that. That's basically it. I gotta feel like they're part of the project direction. You know, you gotta get ego out of the way. And you know, Red Hat really, you know, I worry about this a lot because Red Hat tends to be a gorilla in some respects. You know, we need to be able to lead through technical excellence. We need to be able to lead through technical leadership. We can't just say, oh, we're Red Hat, so, you know, we're in charge, of course. That's not the way we need to do things. We need to set up a project that looks like that. This is enterprise class software. We need to be able to have reliability, performance, and functionality in that order. Right? It needs to stay up, needs to go fast, and then needs to do what it needs to do. So, from a project standpoint, you need to sort of embed that in how the project is designed. That's a lot of, you know, I use the example of a Google project, which Novell just announced. You know, I talked to Nat about it. He said that they removed a lot of source code from that. You know, it lost 50,000 lines of dead weight, well, maybe not dead weight, but a lot of functionality, a lot of code. And one of the reasons they did that, he said, was basically so that people would have stuff to hack on, right? Kids get interested. They want to work on something. They can't do everything. The unfortunate thing about this code is probably going to be pretty boring for most people since it does pretty much everything that it needs to do and does so reliably. It's going to be pretty, I hate to say it, it's going to be kind of a boring project. So, we have to deal with that. We have to set expectations. People are going to come along and say, hey, I want to do X, Y, and Z. And we say, how's that fit into the project plan? You know, one of the interesting things about this project, the product, so let's talk about the product, is that it has amazing documentation. I think there's, just off the top of my head, it's about 3,700 pages of documentation. It's in book format. For just the directory server and the security server. And that's a huge amount of documentation for an open source project. We'll see where that goes too. But if you make a project goal to make sure the documentation is part of the process, you know, you're not going to add anything if you don't document it. Maybe you can actually keep that document. The level of documentation quality is high as it is right now. Integration. Where can we put this? So that it'll add functionality to all our programs. You know, we're really about enabling this. The directory server itself is kind of boring unless you put the programs around it. You know, it takes queries, returns results. You really have to have something to use it with. So we have to make sure that we set up the project in such a way so that other programs, people running other projects and building programs, either custom programs or open source, are willing to use the software. And also, in the project, it needs to be across platform personalities. It can't be just Linux. We have to run other places, especially on the client side. So we have to be able to support Windows. We have to say, you know, you need to use these cross-platform practices and these libraries. And it's already built that way, so it's not too bad. Project non-goals. I don't think anybody ever sets these. What do you not want to do with a project? Does it really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. But
it's like two items.
It's two items? What is it? What is it? What are on it? What's on it? I'm just curious.
I remember one of those.
Yeah,
that's a good goal. Please don't leave the crap on us. Please go signing the bag. Signing the bag?
The other one's like slow rate changes.
Okay. That's a non goal? I guess that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Is that going to in commercial support, particularly SLAs?
Okay, use the SLA word. Project non goals here would be, you know, we'd like to have something that's complete. You know, it's not a huge deal, but, you know, people always want to shrink things down. And I always see these sort of phases that projects go through. They want to be smaller, now we want to be larger, now we want to be smaller. I think that sort of trying to find the middle ground in this case is really nice. But I don't want to see things get too small or spend all your time compartmentalizing code so that you can make it small and it's not really that useful when it doesn't have all the functionality. I'd like to keep the dependency list as short and sweet as possible so it's pretty easy to build. And, you know, have you ever run the output of configure --help on Mozilla?
Yeah.
There are so many options. You know, enable this piece of functionality, disable that piece of functionality, and you know, I think people lose a lot of focus when they spend time worrying about how to quantize all those pieces. It gets kind of crazy. I'd like to try and keep that in the room. You know, we're not looking for real product support at this point. And we don't want a huge matrix. You know, if you're going to run an open VMS, you're kind of on your own. Whatever that one's called. So, things, you know, I worked on the Mozilla project for a long time. One of the things we discovered was getting trademarks right off the bat was really important, you know, because we screwed up a couple of times with the Firebird thing, the Phoenix thing, you know, they all had trademarks because they go off and start a project. And all of a sudden, it's important that people talk about it, and the lawyers get involved. They come knocking. So, we need to get trademarks right at the very beginning. You have clearly defined what we can use, what we can't use. You know, there's a question of whether or not a project you even have trademarks to work with. Establishing a brand in a project is sort of, maybe it's an ongoing too. So not sure. In our case, we wanted to have something. And it's nice to have a separate product for the product, if you don't, right? So this sort of leads me to the other, although it's not on the slide, this leads me to our discussions here on how we decided to think about using the Fedora names for the project. This is basically one of the main reasons right here. It's because we know the trademark status. So it's probably going to be called Fedora for the server, I think, because I don't know about that. So, we spent a good amount of time thinking about licensing. I'm one of those people, I don't have a specific ideology in licensing or the fact that you use the most appropriate tool for the job, right? There are great places where you should use MPL, there are great places where you should use MIT license code. You know, you want to do everything, you don't care how it's used, it just needs to be out there for compatibility reasons. Great, use something that they put in a compatibility area, they put in GPL, put it anywhere. You know, we have GPL, GPL, BSD, MPL. I think the license we're going to actually choose is, and we've had it pretty much nailed down, is GPL plus exception. It's a pretty important goal for us in the directory server project to make sure that if you modify the core of the directory server, add some important piece of functionality that it is returned to the community, right? If you're going to make changes, everybody gets to benefit from it. But at the same time, we want people to be able to add on the directory server in such a way that they can't use proprietary software. We want people to be able to ship it with their products. We want them to be able to expose information to the directory server format through libraries that they may not be comfortable releasing. So we can do a GPL plus exception. I don't know if anybody's tried this before yet.
We have 1.8 million lines of code.
Well, we have the way the exception is worded, there is a very specific set of interfaces that you're allowed to use. And as long as you only use those interfaces through a very clear and distinct plugin API, you can use, if you cross that boundary, you can use any code you want. So it's additional rights granted through that exception without actually causing any restrictions, which works well.
So is your plan to then dual license it?
It's not a dual license.
Okay, so you're not going to try to do a dual license, and this isn't going to be any kind of a plus exception into your GPL?
No.
Okay.
No, we thought about this a while. The GPL says you can't ship anything that has restrictions. I can't remember the exact wording is. No additional restrictions, other than what's given by the GPL, but this is actually an additional right that's granted instead of a restriction. Is that your question?
Well, I don't know enough about your architecture, but I assume you've got a server here, and are you creating client libraries, then they're talking to the LDAP server.
Yeah, well, the client libraries are already dual licensed. Okay. I'm just talking about the server. The client license, the client code is the, that we have anyway, is the LDAP SDK, that it's been available through Mozilla for forever.
Okay.
Right, we've got some changes actually, apparently, that I found out recently, that need to make it back into that code. But it's not a big deal, and we're perfectly happy to license it. Yeah, the dual licensing for the client library is already done. This is just for the server, the core of the server.
Dual licensing, if you want to know.
Sorry?
What are the dual licenses?
The dual license is GPL, let me think. Maybe actually it's a prior license. The GPL, LGPL, MPL. It's basically, you know, the GPL, you know. The MPL, a lot of people may not be familiar with here. It's actually a license that is at a file level. So it says if you make changes to this file, you have to make those changes available. But you can link it against anything you want. Proprietary software, it doesn't matter, just as long as you respect the rights of that particular file. So the MPL does allow proprietary development or respect. Dual licensing. Okay. Copyright. I think a lot of people overlook this, at least in just random projects that take patches. I don't think we can afford to. FSF does copyright assignment. Red Hat does copyright assignment in some cases. Like the Google project does copyright assignment. It's one of the things you have to do. You have to contribute a patch over 5 lines. I'm not sure we have that number. I'm kind of curious. It's probably good about that for us too. Huh? Apache does that too? Okay, well, the answer right there. I think we're going to end up doing copyright assignment just for clarity of licenses. I think the good way to put it is if somebody comes along, they know who to sue. That'd be us. you know, we have to worry about required resources. We have to worry about this once we have the infrastructure, build machines, automated testing, publishing the external website, human cattle. So the people involved in the project. Sorry, it's a little redhead joke, I think.
I get it.
Gets it. It's nice to have a very clear project lead. A little bit of public personality doesn't hurt, all, especially in the beginning. I hate to say it, Jamie was that person for the Mozilla project. I'm not sure if that's good or bad. Maybe it's the wrong personality, it's hard to say. You know, we got developers, we need somebody for documentation, help building initial website, legal systems. I probably shouldn't say that here. We've got most of that stuff done now. We're actually at this point now, trying to build up physical infrastructure. The legal issues are mostly resolved. You know, one of the hard ones is the source release must be usable in the real world on initial release. This is one of the big mistakes I think the Mozilla project made. A lot of people pointed it out. You know, the directory server source code right now has only been built in this one place, right? So it's got all these crazy dependencies on like where the NFS mounts are to find software components that it depends on to build against. You know, it has to have this sort of library, different version of components. And most people on open source stuff, they're like, yeah, I type configure, make install, and that's it. I got a server, it's ready to go. And we're certainly not at that point yet. It actually looks very similar to sort of the Mozilla project when it started. It uses the same building system, it's called Porkoff. And it's not, yeah, it's not believable yet, if you're not in that. So we're working on that. At worst, we're hoping we'll get to the point where you take me, right? And then you can get something up there.
What's the time frame for that?
I don't know. We're talking weeks here. Okay. We're trying to find somebody who has some experience here. You know, it's good to have talking points zone before you release, because we don't live in a world that's just software. We live in a world with our data drives as well. We're going to put up meta and usable components. Issues, yeah, that's what I was talking about. Doesn't sound very easy right now. Although, you know, for 1.8 million lines of code, if you have everything locally cached, it only takes about 15 minutes to run, which actually isn't too bad. Yeah, some more implementations, you guys know all this stuff. I'm sorry, I apologize. This is actually the presentation that I did for people that had a little more time and they were just familiar with it. Yeah, binaries for common platforms is nice. We'll have stuff for Solaris, we'll have stuff for HBGLs, we'll have stuff for Linux, probably Linux too. I don't know about on the server side, but client side for sure. It's important when you're doing a launch that you actually have everything ready and you're willing to talk to developers. I think actually, you know, Google Project is a good example here. They did a great job of this. If you get on the RSC channel, like 150 people on it, and they're all trying to get it to build, and they're all trying to send patches in. There's actually a lot of energy there, which is kind of neat right at the beginning. Yeah, we're going to title when I give this original part too. Anybody have any questions about the server? I can do a quick demo of some of the other stuff. Yes, go ahead.
It seems like one of the natural things here is to start integrating with using the graphic operations combined with the file system like that and doing something cool.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about with integration. I would like to see that happen. I think we're going to put the tools out there to do it. It's just a question of making it possible for people to use that other open source project. I think that should be one of our goals. Yes.
Do you see that as being a valuable component, or do you think the OpenL app stuff is okay on the client side?
I don't know much about the OpenL app stuff on the client side. There's actually been a certain amount of discussion internally about how do we work with the OpenL app project. What do we do for the future? And I think the client side might actually be a good point to start. You know, it might be nice to actually have both projects to have a single client side library. So you already got another client side library. What do we do? And they're similar, right? Because there's a standardized C API which helps. You know, sort of helps alleviate much of the problem. However, you know, we aren't there yet. Does that help? A good number?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I guess it depends, right? You know, they're custom apps most of the time. They're using, that was mostly illustrated with scalability. We're talking about millions of people with millions of accesses per day. but it's way better than what's on the top. So, just, you know, and then they're doing it with permissions and access control lists. You know, one of the nice things about the directory server is when they do replication, the access control lists go with them. Just let me know how that doesn't do. So they're certainly using ethics sources.
In terms of integration, any plans for integrating with SELinux? Like, I'm not sure.
I haven't thought about it. I'm not sure what, where that would be useful. I mean, thinking about it now, I guess there are certain tools that just information like that. So,
you just need like a policy tool?
Yeah,
policies. Yeah.
It seems like a natural fit.
Are you confining the server and using SELinux?
Yeah, well, that was my first impression was, I guess it has access to databases or something, but you know, when you cross the server boundary, it's just one big blob. It's just really sort of describing as information. I don't think it does anything interesting with the bottom.
I think you have to use it for system policies.
Yeah, I mean that's an actual fit of entire code base. Any other questions? The network interface for this is the LDAP protocol,
mm-hmm.
And that's the only interface into it. I believe so. I'm not positive. There's an XML based. I can't remember what it's called. There's an XML based protocol for XML band. Is that what it's called?
Well, this is something.
Yeah, it's some side-by-side server that just uses XML for communicating instead of
XML vectors for it's used for TP people like your XML.
Okay. Yeah, I think if that's what you're talking about, I've heard talk of, you know, they started with one, but I don't know if they
finished it. And then use that gets to I think there are ways to have triggers.
Yeah, one of the things that they do, it's actually extended to the LDAP protocol, I don't know if it's standardized. You can actually do things like when something changes on the server, you can monitor a connection and then the server will tell you when that thing changed. It's pretty important to do with people. It's one of my first questions too. How do we do this without pulling? And there apparently is an extension.
So you've got to be there.
Well, they certainly have their own account for the provisioning in the server, right? You can add users to the server. Is that what you're asking?
No, if you have a single directory, a whole bunch of machines, directory, but not necessarily check this. You want these machines to be able to see if the user got added, that should be creating a whole directory for that user.
I don't think we have that at this point. But I mean, there hasn't been a huge amount of sort of that kind of integration. You're talking about sort of directory server driving sort of classic system integration.
Yeah.
The capabilities are there.
I mean, I think the reason we wanted to get this coming out in open source was so sort of the Linux community can start building those pieces within the proprietary solution to build the apples that we can do around that.
Could you say that again, but maybe a bit louder?
Oh, sorry. I think one of the reasons we wanted to get this directory server and open source it is so there's a very clear place for people to start building up. That's the sort of infrastructure that's been in a lot of proprietary solutions because they can assume the existence of the directory server. And so everyone currently in open source sort of builds their own little hack tower.
Speaking about proprietary software, did Sun fork off this a while ago?
Yeah, there's...
Is everything separate now?
Yeah, it's got its own sort of history as well, I guess. I'm trying to think about when... Because there was Netscape, and then it became, they sort of sold those resources to iPlanet. So iPlanet was actually owned by Sun, and run by Sun, but partially owned by AOL. And so this source code for the directory server was actually included in that deal, and they hacked on it for a while. And then Sun went their own way, and AOL went their own way. And so there was a divergence in the code. So So Sun has their own copy of this code that's pretty close, but it's not the same.
Whatever happened to the email soon?
We've just about it. We got it with our deal. You know, I actually did a web blog posting about this. We have it. We don't have to do it yet.
There's a calendar server in there somewhere.
Yeah, we got that too.
Okay.
Although, you know, to be honest, they haven't been used in a long time.
Yeah.
And they aren't, like, I've tried to get the mail server to know it's not in a buildable state in, you know, an hour of work or whatever. So, I don't know. You know, I know the source code is all there. It's just a question of whether or not you have, like, you know, it hasn't been used in a while and software components that needs to change or need to,
sure.
So you need to, you know, port it forward.
Yeah.
And we didn't get the engineers to use that source code. And that's the hard part. We don't have yet. So, it's there, like the stored email, which made it fast. And
we did get some engineers, just not with the mail server.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's what I said. Okay. We just get a lot of engineers, just not for the mail server. Right? Because they don't want one.
It's the calendar server?
Yeah, I'm with that.
Is the calendar server, that was a fork off corporate time?
CS&T?
Yeah.
It is not the CS&T server.
Okay.
You still have, just a quick question, sorry. Do you still have any OEM obligations with that code? I mean, are there any OEMs you're still servicing and that was assigned with the source code when you bought it?
I really shouldn't talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah, I already talked about more than I should probably, but I'm not going to talk about that.
I was at a previous company that did a deal for source code for the, I think it was directory server.
Okay. Okay. Well, it's be open source soon, so.
I don't have statistics. Not statistics, not in terms of customer fit, in terms of features.
In terms of features, it's pretty classic LDAP server. Because it doesn't do Active Directory. You know, Active Directory is also an LDAP server.
Right.
But it does a lot of other stuff, like they added their own protocol extensions, they added different kinds of authentication, I believe.
Yes.
And we don't do that yet.
But Active Directory is, I mean, I don't want to say you want specifically to build Active Directory, but one of the sorts of things you want, the sort of functionality you want to start providing.
Yeah.
And hopefully it probably
Active Directory is.
The Netscape server does have
Netscape. It does. Yeah, it's but feature-wise, it depends on where, what features you talk about. It is a full-fledged LDAP server. It's an excellent LDAP server. But it doesn't try and be like the network operating system server, directory server.
Okay.
Right? It hasn't tried, you know, we can talk about that kind of stuff before. That's why we want to see more integration, right? Mm-hmm. The deeper integration we get, the more we can do.
Now, you talked about it scaling up very well in terms of access.
Now you want to ask the other question, don't you?
Does it scale down?
I don't know. That hasn't been an application for it in the past. It's a question of, you know, it takes a couple of years to ask for the installer. And
not so much
about
it in terms of just the effort of setting it up and, you know, is it feasible for somebody that has like two boxes to set it up and just centralize it?
It's feasible. It's just a question of whether or not you want to spend those resources on that. It's just something else. I mean, it's not, it's pretty large right now.
Right.
But it's
easy. I mean, it
is
like GUI admin tools.
Yeah, yeah, it's got great admin tools.
It's not actually a little bit easier.
Right. I'm just going to get to that. It's just
your average open source server.
It's very easy to set up. The, you know, it's not, Nalan's not here, is he? Nalan is a guy who, one of the guys who has to deal with OpenLDAP on a regular basis in Red Hat. He finally got this installed a few weeks ago. Oh my god, it has an app interface. I can change the schema. And he was really happy. It was a lot of fun. If you know Nalan, he's a pretty mellow guy most of the time. He's really excited. More than I've seen. But yeah, just to speak of, like, from a feature standpoint, I would love to see that integration. I was going to jump for a second about Samba 4. If anybody went to the State of Samba little talk that they did at LWB this week, it was pretty interesting. Samba 4, it sounds like they've reverse engineered a lot of the protocol stuff for Active Directory. What they ended up doing was creating a very small LDAP server that deals with all the information in Samba. So the big question is, how do we try and set that up? How do we combine all these pieces together? Right? And we might just end up saying, you know, you put Samba in front of your LDAP server for authentication stuff and it forwards on the requests. I mean, we already do this with this LDAP server, and I don't know if OpenLDAP does it or not, but you can, you know, for certain ranges of requests, you can have it go to this other server and forward it on, and another server and forward it on there. So that's basically what, that's not open for some of the fraud.
There's some site on the chance to work with IMDAL and the Kerberos stuff. You just need to do the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a lot of the details of Kerberos and the Kerberos expert.
But maybe you're looking to sort of control some of the stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's talking about it. I'm not sure if we want to do that. We might just do that in some, for that kind of, for that specific thing, as long as we can work with it. As long as the software works together, that's what's important. What was I going to say? So, did we have any questions? Oh, yeah, thank you. That's where I was going with that. I thought somebody's head scan was something very small. There, you know, we talked about doing JSX API. I think I may actually have it right now. For Heimdall, is that, so that's a Kerberos library, it's European similar authentication pieces. I don't want people to know about Kerberos guy. No basics, but I don't know if he's specifically asking about Heimdall. We have Kerberos authentication, I think, in the server right now. Through JSX API, it's not SASL. It's really where we want. I want to be able to use SASL. But I'm not specifically knowing what to do with it.
Well, the one problem I have with the LDAP is it's fairly, I don't know, I find it cousin in general. But then apart from that, the whole LDAP thing is built upon around the idea that people have a lot of boxes, which is great to manage. And most of the LDAP stuff that I've seen is not geared towards, you know, just a small number of machines. Just too much work and too much trouble, people won't do it.
Right.
For the open source and speaking about, you know, building a community and so on and so on, I think it's very important. And that's why I asked about scaling it down. Because if people don't get a real benefit from working with it, and, you know, most people don't have about 100 boxes at home.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
like people won't.
The initial release of this is actually going to be sort of pretty small, I think. We're going to add pieces in. So the small pieces will make it pretty small. But we'll see how it goes. I don't know about ease of installation when you've got something that's small, because it's, a lot of those pieces are required to do the administration interfaces. So it's hard to say. I think that scaling it down is okay, as long as we don't lose the core functionality.
Get gain directly into that application.
Yeah.
Looking for things when we install to be able to add into the schema automatically.
Yeah, that kind of thing would be nice. I was going to give a short demo of some of the stuff. So, how many people here actually stopped and saw the key card demo that the bulk guy Bob Lord was getting at the Red Hat meeting? Yeah, the Bobs. Bob Lord. So, I'm going to give a quick demo of that. I'm not as good as they are at it. But
it'll be more truthful.
It'll be more truthful. It's all good software.
That's cool.
Yeah. Dealing with public key infrastructure, PKI, is a very hard problem in a lot of organizations. I don't know if anybody here, how many people here have actually tried to get, not PGP, an S/MIME certificate for signing mail? One, two, three, a few people? it's a huge pain in the butt, right?
Yeah.
You gotta go go talk to a CA, you gotta generate a key, get a signing certificate, you gotta paste it in your browser. It's like, I couldn't get working on this laptop, unfortunately, because it's an AMI and I'm on Linux. But they had this awesome demo of somebody on Windows trying to get all the certificates for email and browser, and it's like this 8-minute video, you know, all these bizarre dialogues and trying to get certificates saved in text files and pasting them into browsers and pasting them into email. And these guys came up with a really decent smart card-based solution for this. I'm going to have to do this for one here. Basically, it involves using, these are just simple smart cards, right? If you've ever seen the credit cards, it's a similar kind of technology. It's actually got a little Java virtual machine that runs on it. And the software that actually does a lot of the encryption is on the card as a very small application. It stores keys, it generates keys, that's about it. It also decrypts some keys as well, maybe for you if you want. Very limited set of functionality, but it's enough to sort of bootstrap this system. The card is also nice. You know, you can do this stuff, I'm pretty sure you can do this stuff without one of these cards. You can save it on your computer as just a piece of software, but then sort of you've got a problem if you lose your laptop and keep those with it. This is just an added benefit. You know, it's sort of the nice two-pronged piece of insurance when you're dealing with security. It's something you have and it's something you know. You know, a credit card is enough, you might pay as well. So this basically solves that problem. What I'm going to do here is I'm going to do the enrollment afterwards just so you can see what it looks like. But I just want to show you some of the functionality that we have in browser right now. How many people here know that in SSL, SSL isn't just for encryption, it can also be used for identification and authorization. On the back end, I think you're an authorization, but it's good for identification. You can pass along a certificate that says, I have a certificate that says, this is who I am. In HTTP, you can set up a username and password, or you can do it on a website. The other thing is you can do it from the SSL certificate itself. It's actually pretty valuable. Nobody uses it. The advantage of it is that... Sorry?
RHN.
Yes, RHN does use it? Okay, well that's good.
MySQL actually uses it too.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing is that your identity becomes property of the socket if you're doing network connection, which is really handy, right? You don't have to worry about SASE. You don't have to worry about all those pieces. It's just a property. So, just to give you an idea of the software that's going on here, this is Firefox. It is slightly modified in the sense that I think they added a JavaScript call so you can get certain events. But it's not, this is pretty vanilla, right? I want to say that this is not just demoware, it's not just screenshots, it's actually happening, you know, it's actually doing encryption. This is a card that I initialized earlier. It actually belongs to the guy who's doing the demo. And this is a demo site that he's using for describing it. There's a piece of software running on here that listens for when you insert the card. There's a piece of software on here that basically generates the events and does the interface between the card, does all the encryption and stuff, or less than tells the card. The other interesting thing is that in quantity, these are cheap. These are $10 each in quantity. It doesn't require, there's a little card reader here. It's just a pass-through. They sell them as USB keys. The USB software is on the card as well. You don't need anything specific to use this. The next thing is, see if this works. There is. It knows the card is in. And there's a JavaScript event that it listens to on the web page that says, hey, somebody inserted the card. Let me reload its URL. And it asks me for the password in on the card itself. So this is actually, for those of you who have password encryption on your passwords and stuff, and you almost all have the same thing, it's just hardware and software. So basically, that's it. The nice thing is that if you if your application supports it pretty well, the thing is, pull up the card, it's gone. Right? Very nice, in that respect. I can give you a quick demo. Yeah, It's pretty cheap. It's just a pass-through. I don't know. It's probably less than the card. Less than $10, so for that. These don't just come as cards. They also come as little USB keys that you plug in. Same price. So just to give you an example. This is logging into a server actually over our wireless here. Yeah, that password. So just to give you an example, this is also not really demo-ware in the sense that there are small minor changes to Thunderbird that are actually sort of bug fixes but not major functionality changes. That's not made up. This is a message that I sent myself. Here's the key. Same thing. Here it is.
What will happen if you actually put the wrong key in?
It did.
Well, what will happen with
the password and stuff? If you have any password for
it? Is it able...
Sorry, so this is encrypted. Yeah. Well, you can, I guess the card's good. That's encrypted email. I mean, the other nice thing is that when you pull a card out, the application has to be aware of it, but it's certainly handy.
How did that get it? It should just operate back up.
It probably asked for the password.
Yeah. Will it get?
Yeah, that's, I mean,
the other
they.
They asked for the password.
We don't have integration with those pieces. Every application has to ask for it right now. We want to fix that. We could store it in some sort of folder for email that does allow, we got no key ring or whatever. But
so the download is its application level.
Right now it is. It doesn't have to be. But that's just the way it's set up right now for demonstration purposes.
So this is going to work for them or how?
I don't know how we're going to set it up. This is just a demonstration of what we can do. I think that that's sort of an implementation detail, but figuring out where to put that pieces. It's important, but we haven't solved it yet. This is just a demonstration we can do. I just wanted to show you, so that huge, at the beginning I talked about the enrollment process. You have to get all those pieces. I'll go through an enrollment real quick. It's wrong order, right? You're supposed to do the enrollment first to see how easy it is. So this is basically just resetting the card as if it didn't have anything on it. The nice thing about these cards is, right, if you get a card, somebody can send it to you in mail, bank. The bank can send it to you, AOL can send it to you, for example, with the key on it. If they send you the PIN separately, like when you get an ATM card, same idea. You get a free CD, 1,000 free hours on AOL, along with your PIN. There are people out there stealing AOL accounts. If you have something physical, right, that completes the two-piece security card, if you have something physical, it says, this proves who I am because it contains the key, right? And I have the PIN number for it, and I have the password. It's enough, right? It sort of proves that you have a lot of pieces.
Sure. Sorry? Can you cover the cop? I guess you can't cover the cop.
In what sense?
That's a problem. I mean, you're covering this.
I'm not sure. I would imagine that it's pretty difficult.
You can copy the card. The fact is, all the cryptography is done on the card itself, so without the passwords.
Right.
To unlock it.
Yeah, the nice thing is that, the important thing to realize about the card is that the private key is on the card and is generated on the card, okay? And it never leaves the card. So, when I went to decrypt that message, an important thing I actually learned recently about S/MIME I didn't realize was that when you get an S/MIME message in email, in particular, is actually, what's encrypted in there is for asymmetrical encryption, which is public private key cryptography, they actually just encrypt a symmetric key, right, which is using another encryption technique. So it's not like if you have multiple people on the CC list, the key is just encrypted multiple times for each one of those private keys, but not the entire message being encrypted for those people. So the nice thing is the key knows enough to be able to decrypt the symmetric key, but it doesn't have to be used to decrypt the entire message, because you don't want all that traffic going all over the wire. It's really slow. lot of USB devices that aren't, these are pretty simple. So, I'll put this key in, which I've just formatted, so it should be blank. You should notice it and say, hey. So this would be the kind of thing that you get when you want to actually set up your key. The nice thing about this, it's really simple, right? All you do is put in your random process to replace that whole 8-minute worrying about certificates and where they go and how to get them imported into the browser and mail and save some few time. Oh, yeah, it works. So that's it, right? 15, 30 seconds. And then you see you've got a key on that. That's what I wonder if it will work.
Go away.
This is another thing, like, software isn't perfect, but, what did this do? There we go. I'll show you, this is basically it right here. What's on the card. Take it out of the way. Pretty simple. So, it's certainly a better way to get certificates around. You know, if you've got hundreds of employees or thousands of employees, taking a half an hour process and turning it, and it's really complicated, and turning it into 15 seconds for the dialogue is pretty nice. And this is basically what we can do. This is backend entirely by a directory server. And we've got installations that are in the millions of users using this software.
But how would it work? Because in real life, the employee wouldn't stand for the name and all that.
Sometimes. It depends on what the, you know, you can customize it to any process you want, right? Like I said, a person or a company can do this on the backend and mail it to them.
I think the question was, what was the information on that dialogue that's actually required by the card, and what if it was just part of that dialogue?
I think the only thing that's required is the pin. And probably just enough to be able to build this.
So the pin comes on the card?
Yeah.
The pin is required. The pin, you set the pin when you enroll, and then you use that pin when you come to the card. Right, but the first time when you enroll, you choose your pin. You choose your pin.
Yes.
But there's nothing on the card. So if I get hold of a card that's empty, I can set, you know, let's say I'm
I just wanted to use this as an example of the kind of things we can do these days.